From the heart of rural France, this is the Keto Woman podcast, brought to you by me. Hello, keto lovelies. I'm Daisy Brackenhall, and I've spent most of my life struggling with my weight and confidence, and have always had a difficult relationship with food. Even when I finally got to my target weight after weight loss surgery and eating low carb, I couldn't maintain it and I was miserable. I've been keto now for over 2 years, and it has given me the freedom to fall in love with food again, without the constant gain-loss, guilt-virtue cycle of before. Health and happiness is where it's at now, running on fat. Welcome to the Keto Woman podcast. Each week I'll be chatting to inspirational women, maybe even the odd man, to discover the secrets to their success so that I can share them with you. So what is keto? Keto is a way of eating that enables you to switch your body's main fuel source from sugar to fat. Who doesn't want to be a fat burner? But how do we achieve this? A great place to start is by keeping carbs under 20 grams a day. So things like leafy greens and above ground vegetables, plus some nuts and seeds, and the incidental carbs you find in things like dairy. Moderate protein scaled to your lean body mass, and then fat to satiety. Once you're in the swing of things, you can tweak it to suit you. Make your own personalized keto. I'll be asking my guests each week what their keto looks like to show you just how flexible and fabulous this way of eating can be. I'm not a doctor, and most of my guests won't be either, so we can't give you medical advice. It's always best to work with your own doctor because they know you and your medical history, and so have access to the bigger picture. Thank you, Alison Franklin, for supporting me and this podcast by making a pledge at my Patreon page. Would you like to hear your name here at the top of the show? Are you enjoying this podcast and would like to help me make more episodes? Then head over to my Patreon page at patreon.com/ketowoman or hit the support button on the Keto Woman podcast website. It means a great deal to me and you will get to headline the show just like Alison did today. This week's extraordinary woman is Belinda Lennertz. Dr. Lennertz completed medical school at Friedrich Alexander University in Germany in 2005. She did her paediatric residency at St. Louis Children's Hospital from 2006 to 2009, followed by a fellowship in paediatric endocrinology at Boston Children's Hospital from 2009 to 2011 and 2014 to 2015. Dr. Lennertz spent 3 years from 2011 to 14 at Ulm University to obtain credentialing in paediatrics and paediatric endocrinology in Germany and acquire focused training in obesity. She joined the endocrine division at Boston Children's Hospital after finishing her fellowship in 2015. Dr. Lennertz's research focus is on understanding cerebral mechanisms that regulate food intake and energy homeostasis in obesity and type 1 diabetes. Past and recent projects focus on how these brain circuits can be modified by metabolic signaling in relation to food intake. I was introduced to Belinda at Low Carb Denver and was delighted to have the opportunity to record with her. She gave a special presentation about the study she did with the help of Facebook group Type 1 Grit, titled Management of Type 1 Diabetes with a Very Low Carbohydrate Diet. You can find the link to the study in the podcast show notes at ketowomanpodcast.com. Welcome, Belinda, to the Keto Woman podcast. How are you doing today?
Thank you. I'm doing very well.
Enjoying the conference?
It's a wonderful conference. I've had a great opportunity to meet a lot of very interesting people here.
It's really good, isn't it? And I've noticed there are lots of people involved in the Type 1 community here.
Yes, I was excited to meet many people I'd heard of in the discussion group yesterday and to have the opportunity to exchange ideas, and it was wonderful.
Fantastic. Well, perhaps you could tell us a bit about you.
I'm a pediatric endocrinologist at Boston Children's Hospital, and I've taken care of people and children, especially with type 1 diabetes, for several years now and worked mostly though in obesity research. And we have recently come across a Facebook group called Type 1 Grit that are following a very low carbohydrate approach for type 1 diabetes, according to a book by Dr. Bernstein called Dr. Bernstein's Diabetes Solution. And I was just blown away by the success they have in managing their diabetes. as it compares to my experience that I have in my own practice and in seeing, you know, children with diabetes at diabetes camp who eat a standard diet with high amounts of carbohydrate. And so that got us into, you know, wanting to study this approach and into wanting to learn more about it to see if we could bring that to our patients as well.
It's because really logically, it seems like such a good approach. You know, when you're trying to manage blood glucose levels all the time, so it just seems the easiest way to eat this way, to keep your blood glucose within a certain range. Logically, to me, that just seems that it's going to be the easiest way to manage your insulin.
Logically, it does make a lot of sense, right? And in fact, before insulin was discovered, that's how diabetes was managed. And then when insulin came about, you know, carbohydrate restrictions were just loosened gradually over the years to the point where now we recommend a fairly high carbohydrate diet for people with type 1 diabetes. And surprisingly, I don't think that anyone has really done the studies to show that that's the way to go. So I'm, you know, really looking forward to hopefully contribute a little bit to that.
Yeah, exactly. So tell us a bit about the study you've been doing.
For this study, this is really a first effort to look at what people are doing and to describe their success. So what we did for this study is we just posted a fairly simple online survey to the Type 1 Grit community. At the time of the survey, there was about 1,000 people following the low-carb diet recommended by Dr. Bernstein. Now it's over 3,000 the last time I checked yesterday. And so we ask people, you know, what do you do? Like, what's your typical diet? How much carbohydrate do you eat? What's your hemoglobin A1C? We ask them to download some of their meter reads, look at their day-to-day variations in blood glucose levels. We ask for complication rates because a lot of people are worried that, you know, low-carbohydrate diets may place you at increased risk for ketoacidosis and hypoglycemia, poor growth. So we did ask about those things as well. I think what's special about our study is that we actually also ask people for permission to talk to their medical doctors and providers so that we could get some objective information from those people as well to validate what participants had reported. Because one of the largest concerns with surveys is that you never know how what people report or recall correlates with what's actually happening. And so having information from two independent sources really increases the confidence in your findings. We were able to survey over 300 adults and parents of children with type 1 diabetes and found remarkable glycemic control in that group with an average hemoglobin A1C of 5.67%. And that is really something that's thought impossible to achieve for people with type 1 diabetes, because if you want to control your blood sugar to a certain degree, at some point you're going to risk having too low of a blood sugar. Because especially when you eat carbohydrates, your blood sugar goes up and down a lot, right? Every time you eat carbohydrate and cover it with insulin, you will inevitably see a peak followed by a drop in blood sugar. So as you're trying to bring that peak down, you're going to risk to have a low sugar reading later. And of course, that has to be prevented almost at all costs because that could cause a coma, a seizure, severe problems down the road.
That seems to be the biggest fear in the community of the hypos.
That's a huge, you know, because it's a huge immediate threat, yeah. Right? And people experience that, you know, some people have lows every week or every day. And so, you know, you constantly have to mitigate, like, how low can you go without being in trouble?
And is it true that my logic, the higher the peaks, the lower and the more potential you're going to have to dip into that hypo zone? Or does it not necessarily work that way?
Well, it's likely, right? Because a lot of the highs and the lows result from a mismatch between insulin action and carbohydrate uptake. And the larger the dose of insulin that you take, the higher the risk for a big mismatch, right? If you eat a very small amount of carbohydrate and you take a small dose of insulin, you might have a mismatch, but it's not going to be as massive as if you eat 10 or 40 times more carbohydrate and you would have taken 10 or 40 times more insulin for that.
Absolutely. How long was the study, the participants, how long were they reporting back for?
So this was just an observational study. So it was a survey that was posted at one time point. And so we had just asked people to report on their experience. So the study itself is cross-sectional, but we had people reporting being on the diet anywhere between 3 months and 60 years.
Wow, really?
Yeah. Average time on the diet was right around 3 years. Most people between maybe 2 and 5 years.
Gosh, I'd be really interested to hear some of the details with those people who'd been on it for such a long time.
Right. At this point, we just ask everyone the same question. So I don't have a way to know much specific about the people who'd been on it for a long time. But we do hope to do some follow-up work. I actually just got funding for a randomized controlled trial for a very low carbohydrate diet for people with type 1 diabetes compared to a standard diet where we're going to deliver meals to them and then measure their blood sugar control in our research unit, have them on continuous glucose monitors so we can track their readings very closely. And so in order to make this a meaningful intervention, I plan to reach back out to some people of the type 1 grit community and other people who are following low carb. So I think in that setting, I'll be able to tease out more details about what do they really do, like on a day-to-day basis, what's their diet, what's their macros, what, you know, do they eat plant-based or animal-based? You know, all those questions are
fascinating
and unanswered yet.
And so what was the scope of the study and the questions you were asking? And so the results, the feedback you got.
When we heard about this group, you know, first of all, that was a phenomenon, like achieving such good glycemic control that's unheard of in people with diabetes. So really our first point was setting out to make sure they actually plausibly had type 1 diabetes and not maybe MODY or type 2. So we had a lot of questions to, you know, ask for diabetes antibodies and age at diagnosis and those kind of things. And it really appears that plausibly almost all people who participated in the survey do have type 1 diabetes. And then we wanted to know their overall blood sugar control, which is very good, as I said. We had asked for hospitalizations and hypoglycemia rates, ketosis rates, use of glucagon. And so all those possible complications that people think may be associated with a low-carb diet, they were very low in this group when you compare it to other studies that survey people with diabetes and who follow standard protocols. So they had low rates for ketoacidosis, low rates for diabetes hospitalizations, low rates for hypoglycemia. We had looked at growth in children, or at height, I should say, because if you want to look at growth, that's difficult, right? You have to look over a period of time. And because this was just a single time point, we could only look at height. And we had asked some of the physicians to provide growth data from when they're diagnosed. So in a subset of kids, we actually have growth rates over a two-year period in about 30 to 40 kids. And they appear to have grown normally, as far as I can say. And then everyone was, you know, people were above average or even above average tall. So we didn't see any impacts on growth, even though that would not be the right study to perfectly answer that question. We found that people were very satisfied with their diabetes control and strategies. They were less satisfied with the medical care that they received. And that was a big concern that study raised for me, because at least 30% said that they didn't feel comfortable sharing with their diabetes care provider that they were on this diet. And even the people who felt comfortable sharing that, a large proportion of them felt like the physician wasn't supportive and wasn't helpful in managing their diabetes in that setting. And so that made me as a physician very uncomfortable, because I think that an honest relationship between physician and patient is paramount, especially if it comes to something so physiologically influential as a diet, right? Because you have to have a whole different set of considerations. As we heard at the conference, your lab tests will look differently. You may have different risks for complications. When you get sick, you may need different management advice, right? You may not be managed the same as someone who's eating a high-carb diet. So I felt that was a very sad finding, to see that those people who are so tremendously successful and dedicated are so unsupported or feel so unsupported. And I think there is a real lack in information about this approach, and very important, you know, to do more research, to educate the medical community and to help enhance, you know, make resources available so that there could be a better communication, hopefully.
Yeah, because the potential feedback for the advantage of the physicians, you know, I can see so much potential there as well, that, you know, it's not just the patient that's missing out, but it's their physician that's missing out, gaining valuable knowledge for perhaps a potentially better way to manage this problem.
Yeah, I think it's a mess all around, because diabetes is, type 1 diabetes especially, is an incredibly, you know, challenging, dangerous disease to manage. It's very high risk. It's a lot of work, and you really need a team. You shouldn't
just working
have to
together.
Set out. Yeah, you shouldn't have to set out trying to do this on your own.
No, and that just heightens the fear and anxiety that's so closely bound with having the condition, I imagine. And perhaps you could talk a little bit about ketoacidosis in this situation and the potential concern whenever anyone starts talking about ketones. In the community as a whole, there's a real misunderstanding between being in ketosis and ketoacidosis is cited as you shouldn't do keto because of this. And most of us are well schooled in the fact that it's, for the majority of people, it's not an issue unless you're a type 1 diabetic. And so I can imagine that people potentially using this way of eating to help manage their type 1, that must be a red flag that comes up that is going to be something that they're concerned about happening.
Yeah, so I'll start by saying that there is really no research and no literature to actually know the right answer in this. And that's what makes it scary. The concern with eating a very low carbohydrate diet is that most likely, or not most, depending on how low you go, you might be in nutritional ketosis. And in fact, I know that some people specifically aim to be in nutritional ketosis to have health benefits, as we've heard at this conference. If you don't have type 1 diabetes, if you have type 2 diabetes, or if you don't have diabetes at all, your ketone levels almost cannot exceed a certain level. Because if your ketone levels rise to an unsafe threshold, your body will actually make insulin triggered by the ketones themselves to bring them back down. So it's a calibrated system. It's stable. If you have type 1 diabetes, you do not have that opportunity. So if your ketones could go incredibly high without your body having the ability to intervene, because you cannot make insulin. And so that's why people with type 1 diabetes, no matter what diet they're on, they're at risk for having ketoacidosis if they don't get sufficient insulin by injection or by insulin pump. So that's always a risk. And people who eat a standard carbohydrate diet, when their insulin delivery is interrupted, or when they get sick and become so insulin resistant that whatever insulin they get doesn't work, the first thing you see is their blood sugar will go very high. And then you'll know to check for ketones. And then you'll know that you're in ketoacidosis. And you could, usually if you're vigilant, you could treat it before it becomes real dangerous. So it's preventable. If you eat a low-carb diet, your insulin delivery may be interrupted, or you may be insulin resistant from an illness, and your blood sugar may still not rise very quickly because you don't have any carbs on board, right? You don't have carbs in your gut, and you could still have a very low blood sugar even in the setting of insulin deficiency. And you may go into ketosis or ketoacidosis even without having the typical warning signs of it. And I think that that's one of the concerns people have. I've heard people be worried about potentially even having a lower threshold for ketoacidosis because ketones are already elevated and you're kind of closer to, though I'm not sure if, you know, again, there isn't really any good studies to support. I wanted to point out that, you know, even though the type 1 grit community showed that they really didn't have a lot of ketoacidosis hospitalizations or ED visits or episodes at all, this is a special group. Like, those are very highly motivated, vigilant, incredibly engaged people that are very in tune with their diabetes care. There might be other people who don't pay as much attention, for whom I think the risk is probably substantially larger than this group that I had the opportunity to work with. I think what I want to say is, in my opinion, again, without having a lot of research behind it, I want to say that it's probably important to measure your ketones, especially if you're on a low-carb diet, to know what your baseline level is. And if you see deviation, like if you feel sick and if you feel unwell, to check it then. And if you see any increase from what you usually run, to be careful and to know that you could be at risk for having ketoacidosis.
Yes, I think Jake Kushner mentioned that yesterday. He was showing this, the difference between, with the constant glucose monitor, the difference in the graphs, just in general, between people eating the standard diet and on, you know, a keto or low carb diet, that variance was incredible. But he mentioned about a particular time of risk was if something like your insulin pump or something happened during the night, and so you weren't aware of it and you woke up and maybe the ketones could be going up then. But he spoke about that relative difference, just as you said, knowing what your standard baseline is and what it's increased to. It's more important is that difference between the two than having a specific number that everyone should be concerned when their ketones get to a certain amount. It's very specific to you and what the differential is for you.
Right, because I think there is a huge gray zone. You know, for example, if you're on a high carb diet and your ketones are 1 and 1.5, that's not normal. So you, at that point, even you would want to start troubleshooting and looking for problems with your equipment or your insulin, or, you know, to see if you're sick, you may want to take extra insulin to cover for that, because that's not normal on a standard diet. If you're on a low carb diet, you may habitually be at 1.5. You may even be at 2 or 3, right? Depending on your constitution and what you do on your diet. But then going from maybe 2 to 3, that could be a warning sign, right? We know that when you're at 10, you're in trouble. But when you're at 4 or 5, could that still be diet? Could that already be ketoacidosis? And the truth is, you don't want to go to 10 before you intervene, because that's when you're really in, you know, you could be in fairly severe ketoacidosis. So I think the key about ketoacidosis and successfully treating it to catch it early. And so the early warning signs may be subtle if your ketone levels are always elevated, and knowing your levels will help you recognize a small increase and may help you treat early if you have to, because that's when you can still get a handle of it at home and be fine in a few hours versus having to go to the hospital and putting yourself at risk.
Yes, again, it's this empowerment of the self-knowledge and the knowledge of the environment in which you're working in. And again, the slightly sad aspect of is if you have this mismatch with your medical team, you know, because again, it's another example of where it's so important to be working closely with them.
Right. And that's where I know Jake Kushner and myself certainly as well. We're trying, you know, to help inform the medical community about this approach, and also specifically hope to provide research that may support a meaningful way to handle this.
And I know you did a presentation last night here at the conference, a special presentation for probably predominantly type ones, but I know there were other people there as well. Was there anything, you know, of particular interest that came up in the Q&A that you'd like to share?
You know, I think it's a lot of the same questions. People are very interested about the ketoacidosis question. I get a lot of questions about hypoglycemia, and specifically, you know, asking, is it actually safe to be hypoglycemic when you're on a ketogenic diet? I think there is a notion that if you have high enough ketone levels and your brain can run on ketones, maybe it's not as dangerous to be in hypoglycemia, and maybe you'd be relatively protected. People say that they don't feel the lows as much, that they feel fine, they're fully functional. Why should I worry, right? I think, again, that's a little bit of a dangerous territory, because even if you feel fine, you're incredibly close to a threshold where you may not be fine. And to be truthful, there isn't any studies or there isn't a lot of data to show you that you'd be fine solely on ketones. There's a few experiments, there are some animal studies, and we're not going to be able to study that either, because you can't really deplete someone in an experimental setting of glucose to the point where you could show, yes, I'm totally safe and fine without it, right? And who would want to risk their own brain?
Exactly.
So the brain is very vulnerable. If the brain doesn't have it needs fuel, it has no stores, right? If it's not fueled properly, you would, you know, you could have a seizure, you could go into coma, you could have brain damage. And I do think that ketones are protective to a degree, and I do think that the brain can use them as a fuel. But do you really want to push your limits, you know, to test that? And I think that maybe not.
I guess that's where the anecdotal feedback really becomes important. So if people have got the data from their monitors and they can also feed back, you know, well, this is where, relatively speaking, I was quite low, and it might be, that might be something that would affect somebody differently who is on a standard diet to me. And they can just feedback where you were saying that potentially some people were saying that they felt maybe they didn't experience hypos in the same way. So I suppose that's where the only thing, like you say, because you can't test it, is to just collect that anecdotal evidence.
And I also think that that's a double-sided sword. Is that what you say in English?
Yeah.
But because you're low and you don't feel it, people think, okay, I could be low. I'm safe.
Yeah.
But if you're low and you don't feel it, that's also a genuinely unsafe situation, right? Because feeling a low is a warning sign that helps you intervene. So if you're losing that warning sign, you could potentially go low without knowing, and you could go severely low without having a proper warning. Like if someone who eats a standard carb diet and who generally runs high, they'd feel terrible when they have a 70. At 70, you're miles away from, you know, a dangerous zone. So you have a lot of time, and you get a lot of warning to intervene. If you don't feel, like if you feel fine at 50 or even 40, as I've heard from some people, you're really close to a zone where it may potentially be a little bit more dangerous, and that we don't know enough about. I can't dismiss hypoglycemia just because you don't feel it.
No, absolutely.
Because the feeling is also a warning sign.
Yeah. How much feedback did you have? Was it part of the study with how people were feeling, if, you know, how much improvement they were seeing from switching to this way of eating in their general well-being and lifestyle? I know it's something that can really impact that day-to-day living and cause a lot of anxiety, and the potential of a way of eating to diminish that and really improve your overall well-being seems like probably the biggest benefit, in a way, to just being able to live a quote-unquote normal life.
Right. So we had asked, you know, questions and had provided some scales to see how do you feel, how is your general health. And we'd also asked some open-ended question, you know, what would you like to tell us, you know, about this approach? And we got, you know, very positive responses. Like people report that they're feeling great, that they had been able to put aside of a lot of their concerns about diabetes and about highs and lows, that they feel that they're able to focus better, and that they are more, you know, they feel just healthier because they don't have to go through those ups and downs that it takes a lot of anxiety, especially off the parents' backs. A piece of caution, though, is that obviously those are people who've adapted this approach successfully and who are enthusiastically behind it. So you will get the positive answers, right? Like if a person, say, had tried it and had hated it or had been miserable or had maybe even been non-committal, they would have probably not continued to be on this approach, and they would have not ended up in this study.
Good point. So there is that bias inherent.
Right. So there is inherent bias to this, but you know, those people who are successfully doing it love it.
Fantastic. And how have you found this influences your practice?
I've been supportive of patients who've chosen to be low carb. I've tried to learn as much as possible as I can. I have, even before I did the study, I did read the book that Dr. Bernstein had written. I actually went to visit with him for a week to learn from his practice. I feel like it'd be supportive. I don't feel like I'm in a position where I can teach people that approach yet, because
I was going to ask you if it's something you're actually at the level where you recommend, or whether you're just supportive of people who've decided to do it themselves.
I think I'm still being supportive, and I'm still trying to explore structures. Like I haven't at this point yet a dietitian who can actively support. I don't have a diabetes nurse educator that can actively support. We're in the process of trying to build those structures because I'm intrigued, but I do think to offer actual teaching and education as a medical team, it's a high responsibility, and I want to do it right. I don't want to do, you know, half finished things and then end up with patients who are not optimally cared for.
Absolutely. Yeah, good approach.
So I support, you know, if someone comes to me and says, this is what I'm doing. I'm eager to help them and learn with them, but I'm not yet offering.
Yeah, so people aren't finding that mismatch that we mentioned before that is existing.
That's paramount, right? Like, to keep the lines of communication open. Mm-hmm. And
yeah, I mean, it kind of seems obvious to me, but that whatever approach your patient is taking, it's always going to be paramount to work closely with them to give them the best care you can.
Yes.
And you already mentioned there are some more studies that are going to follow on the back of this.
Yeah, I'm right now in the process of, planning a randomized controlled trial, which is, as you've heard a million times at this meeting, considered the gold standard. It's really what we need to show if this could be successfully brought to a wider audience, right? There is always going to be motivated people that can do certain things and that need to be supported. But my question as a physician is too, is there something that I can do to bring this to other people? And I feel like once I do that trial, I'll have learned a lot for my own practice and hopefully can provide information for other providers who might want to be interested in promoting this. So this is, going to be a smaller trial, about 40 people. And if it's successful, next step might be larger in maybe multi-center studies and hopefully informing diabetes care.
Absolutely. I usually ask my guests at this point, and I appreciate I'm springing it on you, for a general top tip for our listeners.
I think keep an open mind and be supportive and try to work together as a team.
Perfect. And that certainly fits in with what you've been talking about. It's been a great pleasure talking to you today. Thank you so much. And I wish you all the best for your future trials and studies and your practice.
Thank you.
To get the resources and links from the show, please go to ketowomanpodcast.com. Are you my next extraordinary woman? Maybe you've got an idea for a show, a topic you want to hear about. Let me know how I can tickle your earbuds by dropping me a line at daisy@ketowomanpodcast.com. If you fancy joining me on this exciting adventure and want to help me create new episodes, please go to my Patreon page at patreon.com/ketowoman or simply hit the support button on the Keto Women Podcast website. Please help other people hear about and find this podcast by reviewing the show on my Facebook page and iTunes or whichever podcast app you use. It doesn't go unnoticed by me, the people who regularly like, share and comment on my posts. Your support means the world to me. Thank you. This week's end quote is from Ernest Hemingway, or possibly Leonard Cohen. There seems to be some debate. Via Becky Cordhill. Thanks for sharing, Becky. We are all broken. That's how the light gets in. Bye-bye, keto lovelies.